Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments you can hear Joan Knows. Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, brings us the Vatican Week in review. But first we join Jill Bevilacqua, who presents this week's edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye.
The tax collectors and the sinners were all gathering around Jesus to hear him, at which the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Then he addressed this parable to them. A man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the share of the estate that is coming to me." So the father divided up the property. Some days later, this younger son collected all his belongings and went off to a distant land, where he squandered his money on dissolute living. After he had spent everything, a great famine broke out in that country, and he was in dire need. So he attached himself to one of the propertied class of the place, who sent him to his farm to take care of the pigs. He longed to fill his belly with the husks that were fodder for the pigs, but no one made a move to give him anything. Coming to his senses at last, he said, "How many hired hands at my father's place have more than enough to eat, while here am I, starving? I will break away and return to my father, and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against God and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands.'" With that he set off for his father's house. While he was still a long way off, his father caught sight of him and was deeply moved. He ran out to meet him, threw his arms around his neck, and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against God and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son." The father said to his servants, "Quick, bring out the finest robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and shoes on his feet. Take the fatted calf and kill it. Let us eat and celebrate, because this son of mine was dead and has come back to life. He was lost and is found." Then the celebration began. Meanwhile, the elder son was out on the land. As he neared the house on his way home, he heard the sound of music and dancing. He called one of the servants and asked him the reason for the dancing and the music. The servant answered, "Your brother is home, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has him back again in good health." The son grew angry at this and would not go in. But his father came out and began to plead with him. He said in reply to his father, "For years now I've slaved for you. I never disobeyed one of your orders. Yet you never gave me so much as a kid goat to celebrate with my friends. Then when this son of yours returns after having gone through your property with loose women, you kill the fatted calf for him?" "My son," replied the father, "you're with me always, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice. This brother of yours was dead and has come back to life. He was lost and is found."
Is there any other parable which has had such a press as that of the prodigal son? So often quoted, so variously interpreted, some emphasizing the role of the father, some that of the elder brother. And the prodigal? He needs no emphasis. His story is universal. In different ways, to a greater or lesser extent, the parable has relevance to each and every age and condition. It will never become out of date. But why do we call it the parable of the prodigal son? The word prodigal doesn't appear in any of the English versions I've looked at. Who first gave it that title, I wonder, and why? Back to the roots first. The Latin lexicographer Festus, in the 2nd century, says that the Romans called victims wholly consumed by fire prodigae hostiae, meaning wasted victims. Presumably, he was talking about sacrificial victims. And he adds that those who waste their substance are therefore called prodigals. Brewer discounts this explanation and writes, the word ultimately goes back to the Latin pro digere, meaning to squander, or literally to drive forth, from pro meaning forth and agere to drive. The notion was that persons who had spent all their patrimony were driven forth to be sold as slaves to their creditors. The dictionaries seem to agree on the meaning of prodigal as wasteful, even recklessly wasteful, given to extravagant expenditure, lavish in the bestowal or disposal of things, was a 1596 definition, and a modern dictionary defines a prodigal as anyone who spends or gives lavishly and foolishly. It adds, prodigal son, a repentant sinner or reformed spendthrift. This is what is generally understood by the word and almost always with reference to money. The nobility is prodigal in expenses, spending more than their revenues in diet and apparel. This was a quotation of 1601, but no source was given. Another quote of 1864 runs, nature is prodigal of human life. There is also a positive meaning, yielding abundantly. Today's dictionary suggests lavish of new ideas, and an older volume refers to May, prodigal of flowers. Which reminds me of a delightful incident recounted in her garden book by Vita Sackville-West. It's spring, and she's been out in the country driving past orchards lovely with apple and cherry blossom.
I came home expecting no further delight that day, but on arrival I saw a closed van at the front door. A smiling young man confronted me, saying he did not know if I would be interested in these, and opened the van as he spoke. These were giant pansies, thousands and thousands of them. The van's dark interior was a cavern of colour. Some royal hand had flung rugs of velvet over the stacks of wooden trays. Purples were there, and subtler colours than purple. Bronze and greenish-yellow and claret and rose-red, all in their queer cat faces of crumpled velvet. I stood amazed.
And she ends with a practical gardener's suggestion.
As for those whose houses do not lie on his road, a packet of seed should serve the purpose, and by next spring the ground should appear as though spread with the most sumptuous carpet from Isfahan.
The most telling of modern definitions refers to a prodigal son or daughter, a person who leaves home to lead a prodigal life but returns repentant, with allusion to the parable in Luke. So well known is the parable that no explanation is added. But the departure of a son or daughter to lead a prodigal life is not perhaps the most common reason for a young person to leave home. A dash for freedom from parental control or a yearning for independence is more usual. And anyway, how many parents today have an estate to share among their children? As for a repentant return, it's not always the case. Far more likely, the money has run out. It happened to my younger son, who said he'd like to try living on his own. Fine, go ahead, we said. So off he went. 2 years later, he was back. They've put the rent up, he sighed. But this was only a local departure. Our parable is on a much more drastic scale. And in his poem, Departure of the Prodigal Son, Rainer Maria Rilke questions such a decision.
To depart, whither? To unrevealing distance, to some warm, unrelated land, that back clothwise will stay without all feeling beyond all action, garden, sea, or sand. And to depart, why? Impulse, generation, impatience, obscure hope and desperation not to be understood or understand. To take on all this and in vain persistence, let fall perhaps what you have held, to die alone and destitute, not knowing why. Is this the way into some new existence?
But there is something in the quality of prodigality that belongs peculiarly to youth. Life is prodigal in its gifts to the young, abundance of health and vigour, and of course, abundance of time. And youth is prodigal in its use of those and other gifts. In a poem about the celandine, Wordsworth ends with a reflection on this. He has seen the flower in its youth, shrinking from cold and rain. Now it is old, it stands forth, an offering to the blast, not from choice, but from necessity.
The sunshine may not cheer it, nor the dew. It cannot help itself in its decay. To be a prodigal's favourite, then, worse truth, a miser's pensioner, behold our lot. O man, that from thy fair and shining youth age might but take the things youth needed not.
And Shakespeare reminds us how the young lover is lavish in his promises. When the blood burns, how prodigal the soul lends the tongue vows. Certainly the younger son in the parable had the fire in the blood, proper to youth, and rushed on his ruin, living riotously. He had never been in need, so could not imagine what it was like until it happened to him. Life at home had been comfortable but not exciting, and he no doubt had to work on the land like his brother. But with money in his pocket, why wait? Give me my share now. And a vision of unending pleasure rises up before him. Perhaps something like the illusory world Scott Fitzgerald wrote of in The Great Gatsby. America in the 1920s, jazz age New York, brightly lit playground of irresponsible millionaires, as one critic put it.
There was music from my neighbour's house through the summer nights. In his blue gardens, men and girls came and went like moths among the whisperings and the champagne and the stars. On buffet tables, garnished with glistening hors d'oeuvre, spiced baked hams crowded against salads of harlequin designs and pastry pigs and turkeys bewitched to a dark gold. By 7 o'clock, the cars from New York are parked 5 deep in the drive, and already the halls and salons and verandas are gaudy with primary colours. The bar is in full swing, and floating rounds of cocktails permeate the garden outside, until the air is alive with chatter and laughter, and casual innuendo and introductions forgotten on the spot. The lights grow brighter as the earth lurches away from the sun, and now the orchestra is playing yellow cocktail music, and the opera of voices pitches a key higher. Laughter is easier, minute by minute, spilled with prodigality.
But the beautiful bubble bursts and reality strikes at last. And our hero finds himself not only penniless, but starving, and the ultimate ignominy looking after pigs, which for a Jew were unclean animals. And he would willingly have filled his belly with the husks the pigs were eating. In the Italian, the word carubo is used for the husks, pods of the carob bean, in Greek keration. Carob beans were also used as a unit of weight, and from this comes our word carat, for the measure of the purity of gold in an alloy. Precious husks indeed. As for the pigs, we usually think of them as munching acorns, as in these lines from Pigs in the Wood by Robert Bloomfield, a late 18th century writer.
No more the fields with scattered grain supply the restless wandering tenants of the sty. From oak to oak they run with eager haste, and wrangling share the first delicious taste of fallen acorns, yet but thinly found, till the strong gale have shook them to the ground. It comes, and roaring woods obedient wave. Their home well pleased, the joint adventurers leave. The trudging sow leads forth her numerous young, playful and white and clean the briars among. And o'er their heads, loud lashed by furious squalls, bright from their cups the rattling treasure falls.
When the foreign country he's wasted his substance in is struck by famine, the young prodigal finds no one willing to offer him food, not even the carob beans, for although normally given to the pigs as fodder, they were eaten by humans in time of famine. His situation is desperate. His fair-weather friends have melted away, Now he's a pauper, and he doesn't seem to have made any real ones. With a famine raging, moreover, it's every man for himself. So now, the illusory world he has lived in, a fast-fading memory, and a bitter one at that, he thinks of the men who work for his father, who have more than enough to eat, while he is starving. "I will arise and go to my father," ran the old version, and we know the rest. And now the real hero makes his appearance. At the beginning, all we're told of the father is that he divides the property. We may only imagine his feelings as he watches his younger son leave without so much as a glance behind. But he never loses hope, and is out there, one imagines, almost daily, looking into the distance. And when he sees him, still far off, he runs to meet him, falls on his neck and kisses him. This gospel is called by our liturgist a great hymn in praise of God the Father's merciful love. And a Bible scholar points out that this chapter of Luke is illumined by the phrase spoken by the scribes and Pharisees. This man welcomes sinners and eats with them.
The theme of the merciful and generous love of God who pardons is illustrated in a stupendous triptych of parables: the lost sheep, the lost drachma, the prodigal son. The stories have their climax not in the losing, but in the finding. Joy, celebration, happiness. Contrary to its traditional title, the third parable has as protagonist not so much the son prodigal of sin and betrayal as the father prodigal of love.
After the son has confessed his fault, come the celebrated words to the servants to bring out the finest robe and put it on him, the ring for his finger, sign of authority.
The ring is probably one with the family seal. To put the ring on his finger then means to re-establish the dignity of the son and acknowledge his authority over the property and the servants. The shoes, or sandals, represent the dress of the free man compared to the slave.
Most quoted phrase of all is the order to kill the fatted calf, still used today when we want to celebrate a person, to welcome with the best of everything, as one definition has it. And the third member of the family? He is furious when the servants tell him the reason for the music and dancing and refuses to enter the house. This self-righteous behaviour of the son, who has slaved for the father for years and never disobeyed, is a reflection, writes a scholar, of the behaviour of the Pharisees, who murmured against Jesus and his generosity towards sinners. The reasoning of the elder brother is that of reasonable and limited human justice, writes Piero Bargellini. His objections are those of the Pharisees, but the way the father justifies the celebration puts a different complexion on the matter.
From sorrow for a death and joy for a return to life, there is no place for reasonings, trials, distinctions and refinements. There's room only for unlimited joy, which should be shared by all.
Well, thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua. She'll be back again at this same time next week with the next edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. In the meantime, let's join Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, who brings us a bird's eye view of the past week in the Vatican. Joan, welcome back.
A busy week it was. It'll be a little quieter this coming week because, of course, the Holy Father's going on retreat with outside of Rome with ranking members of the Roman Curia.
We're getting to Sunday. But refugees on the agenda.
Looking back, as we always do in this segment, we have, of course, the Sunday Angelus. And the Pope always refers to the Gospel of the day, has some reflections on that, and then mentions other matters that are dear to his heart and or on the front pages of the news. And he did pray and ask people for prayers for the refugees who flee wars and what he called, quote, other inhuman situations. And he especially, of course, drew attention to the ongoing, as we speak, the migrant situation in Greece and other countries that are on the front line of offering aid to those who need you open your borders, but then all of a sudden it's a deluge. Basically, he said, of course, the world needs a united response to this. But on the positive side, if we can say so, the Pope welcomed the news about the cessation of hostilities in Syria and, again, invited everyone to pray that what he called this window of opportunity would give relief to the suffering people there, open the way to dialogue and and desired peace. And then there was kind of a little P.S., a brief mention of Fiji. We don't hear of the Fiji Islands being in the news too often, but they were hit hard by a devastating cyclone. And the Pope said he was praying for the victims and obviously all involved in the relief operations. And then he moved to Monday. The Holy Father on Monday did meet members of the Carabinieri who served the Vatican area of Rome. And of course, we see a lot more of them this year of the Jubilee. And they are the military police, and they serve both military, actually, and civilian populations. And of course, the Holy Father thanked them for their huge cooperation with the Holy See to ensure, as I just mentioned, the smooth progress of the Holy Year. And he's particularly highlighted their patience and professionalism in dealing with pilgrims and tourists. And Tuesday was a quiet day. Sometimes it can be filled with activities, but mostly the Pope is getting ready for the Wednesday general audience. And he was reflecting on God's fatherly love and forgiveness. And as he's done so many other times, it's like Pope Francis can't tell us enough how much God, our Father, loves us. And to the point of forgiveness, there's nothing he can't and won't forgive. And so he stresses that. He said, when God's children err in their ways, God calls out to them lovingly, and he never, ever disowns them. And he said, this is the love of our Father, the mercy of God. And to have a Father like this gives us hope and trust. And then he was talking about erring and pointed out, he said, we often choose to tread the wrong paths in search of justification, justice, and peace. And he said, the right path, of course, is choosing and following God. Then he came out with like, and he did I hear him say this? He said, I think of some of the benefactors of the church who come with an offer for the church, and their offer is the fruit of the blood of people who've been exploited, enslaved with work, and they're underpaid. And he said, I'll tell these people, please take back your checks. The people of God don't want dirty money, but hearts that are open to the mercy of God. Referring once again, he did have some beautiful words while talking about God's love and his mercy. And the Pope commented that when a person is sick, he turns to a doctor. And so when he has sinned, he should turn to God. Because if he turns to the witch doctor, he will not be healed. But the real doctor, God, of course, he will be healed. Now, as if the audience was not enough on Wednesday, at the end of the audience, of course, the Pope had, again, a special thought and mention for the refugees, so many of them attempting to enter Europe, and they simply don't know where to go. And the Pope asked the faithful to be open in this year of grace to the Father's merciful invitation to come back to him. And as if those concluding remarks weren't enough, the Pope had two interesting meetings. He met with Spanish tenor Plácido Domingo. He said, I would love one day to sing for Pope Francis, who speaks my native language, as I did for Paul VI, John Paul II, and Benedict XVI. And I have a feeling that all he had to do was say that, and those words will come true. Someday we will sit in the studio and report on how he sang for the Holy Father. And then the Holy Father had another meeting with Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, because he had led an ecumenical interreligious delegation. I think there were seven of them, leaders from Baltimore on pilgrimage to Rome. And so we had leaders from the Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, and several Protestant churches in Baltimore who came to Rome. And not only to strengthen, as they said at an interview at the airport before leaving Baltimore, but strengthen the ties that unite them, and they wanted the blessing of Francis on their commitment to work together to address key areas in the city. And it's how can we give people a sense of dignity? How can we make them understand that violence is not the answer to injustice? So a big day for the Pope, lots of meetings on Wednesday. And then Thursday, the Holy Father met the participants in the Pontifical Academy for Life. They are here for a plenary session. The Academy began its meeting on the 3rd of March, finishes on Saturday, and the theme is Virtues in the Ethics of Life. And the Pope said, you know, virtue is not just a habit. It's the constant, renewable ability to choose good. I really like that definition. And he said it's not an emotion, and it's not a skill acquired through a refresher course, let alone a biochemical mechanism. Virtue is the highest expression of human freedom. It's the best that the heart of man offers. That is so beautiful. I think I'll print it and put it on the wall next to my computer. Anyway, the Academy was set up in 1994 and studies issues linked to the promotion and defense of human life, as we can guess, from an interdisciplinary perspective. And, of course, its main thing is to promote a culture of life. And then the Holy Father also on Thursday did have an audience with the Prime Minister of East Timor.
And there was some other news as well, wasn't there?
Oh, there was other news on Thursday, kind of the end of a four-day session. Cardinal Pell, who, of course, is the Holy Father's point man at the Secretariat for the Economy, Cardinal George Pell of Australia, he, via videotaping in a Rome hotel from, like, late at night to early in the morning, given the time difference between Rome and Australia, he gave testimony to the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses into Child Sexual Abuse. And a number of people who had been abused years ago by priests in Australia were present. The cardinal afterwards released a statement and met with journalists on his final day of testimony, but not until he had met with this group who had come from Australia to attend his testimony. And he called the encounter honest and occasionally very emotional. And, of course, he acknowledged, as he really did for 4 days of testimony, that evil was done. He said, "We all want to try to make things better, actually and on the ground, especially for survivors and their families. And I undertake to continue to help the group work effectively with the committees and agencies that we have here in the church in Rome, especially the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors." And he also had very heartfelt words for those who, because of this, and certainly not just in his country, those who had taken their life due to the abuse. And the cardinal said one suicide is still too many. And there have been tragic ones. And he said, "I'm working with the group to try and stop this so that suicide is not seen as an option for those who are suffering." So a very emotional week of testimony for both the cardinal and those present at the hearings. And then his very heartfelt meeting with the survivors of abuse, and it had been requested by them. Now, Friday and Saturday, big days here. This is the third year of what the Pontifical Council for Promoting the New Evangelization that the Pope charged with setting up and fulfilling the Holy Year of Mercy. The Council 3 years ago set up this 24 hours for the Lord, a 24-hour period really devoted to penance, to the sacrament of penance. Confession, there will be an event starting in St. Peter's Basilica tonight with the Holy Father, a penitential event, ending tomorrow at 5 at p.m. at the same time.
And Tomorrow, Saturday.
And there will be penitential services, in particular in 4 churches in Rome, open even throughout the night. The Church of the Sacred Heart, which is on Piazza Navona, and then the well-known Santa Maria in Trastevere, the Church of the Holy Stigmata off of Largo Argentina, and then Santo Spirito in Sassio, which is the church on Borgo Santo Spirito, parallel with Via della Conciliazione. It's the church known for being the Church of Divine Mercy.
Thank you very much, Joan.
You were listening there to Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome. That brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. This is Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.